Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. It's the 29th of August, 2013, and the world is on the brink of outright disaster, and that can only mean one thing. It's time to bring our old friend Pepe Escobar back on the program. So, Pepe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Disaster calling.
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, I love talking to you, and I love picking your brain and getting your insight on things geopolitically, but it seems we're never talking about happy things, are we? Well, today...
happiness.
No. Well, obviously, this is not a happy time. We are on the brink of another military intervention, and we're still waiting to see what the commander-in-chief and his cohorts in NATO decide to do. But as we're waiting, obviously, we're still looking at the situation and trying to assess it. And on that note, I want to draw people's attention, of course, not only to your work in general, your books, Globalistan, How the Globalized World is Dissolving into Liquid War, and Obama Does Globalistan, but specifically what you've been writing in the last few weeks about the situation in Syria. And I want to draw people's attention specifically to an article that was on Asia Times last month that I think was pretty prescient, in that it predicted that the status quo would have to be changed pretty soon. And that was an article called War Against Iran, Iraq, and Syria. And this concentrates on something that I think is a much more reasonable idea for what this is really about, other than a chemical weapons attack, and that is the pipelines. As we've talked about on this program before, a lot of this comes down to the pipeline politics that is increasingly hardwiring geopolitical relations onto the grand chessboard, and this is no exception, with a memorandum of understanding having recently been signed between Iran, Iraq, and Syria for a new gas pipeline that really could potentially change the game if it was allowed to proceed. Let's tell people about this pipeline and this memorandum of understanding that was just signed.
Okay, this is absolutely essential. It's the Iran-Iraq-Syria pipeline, which even some parts of the Middle East, they call it, with a little bit of sense of humor, in fact, the Islamic pipeline. Not exactly, right? But this is absolutely essential for two reasons. One, it bypasses two of the nations who are absolutely keen on regime change in Syria, Turkey and Qatar. The whole thing with Qatar, as we all know, changed completely for the past few weeks, in fact, for the past 2 months. Don't forget that until 2 months ago, Qatar was being hailed all over, not only in the Middle East, but even some parts of Europe and in D.C., as the next mini superpower. They were everywhere. Their foreign policy was everywhere. Their cash was everywhere. They were buying everything legally, like real estate in London and Paris, and illegally, like mercenaries all over the Middle East to fight in Syria. But then the emir is gone. He deposes himself, which is a story that is absolutely impossible to confirm with any official sources in Doha. But we can get around it. We can talk to people in Iraq. We can talk to people in the Emirates, traveling Saudis, you name it. And the picture is that essentially he was invited to depose himself because of Saudi pressure. This Saudi pressure was applied by Bandar Bush, Bandar bin Sultan, former ambassador in Washington, the capo of the old Kapi in the Afghan jihad in the 1980s, very close to the Bush family, the Carlyle Group. We all know this story. So Bandar Bush was not dead. We saw that he had been dead for a year. We all remember that, since that attempt against him in July 2012. He resurfaced 1 year later, and his first photo 1 year later is shaking the hands of Vladimir Putin in Moscow. This is a story that I think a lot of people are already familiar with. The famous 4 hour and something meeting between Bandar and Putin, where essentially Bandar was trying to sell to Putin the idea that if you start opposing a UN resolution, a UN Security Council resolution, and he backed off in terms of supporting Assad, well, the Saudis would start buying, for starters, $15 billion in Russian weapons, with more contracts following. They would not interfere with, very important, pipelines, with Russian pipelines going to Europe, which means basically the North Stream and the South Stream, so which is ridiculous. And Putin already said that to Bandar straight away. Look, we don't have a problem with that, unless you sabotage our pipelines, right? And obviously, after 4.5 hours, And he was not getting what he wanted, which was Putin's, okay, Assad is toast. He said, and this is quoted verbatim from the leak. The leak was from a Russian diplomat. You went to an Arabic newspaper first, Al Safir in Lebanon. Then it was translated into English, and then it was circulating all over. It's a completely crazy story. But it makes portions of the dialogue make sense completely, considering the way Bandar articulates himself and Putin's responses as well. Bandar, in the end, to sum it all up, he said, look, there's going to be a problem for you with the Sochi Olympics. I'm going to release the jihadists that we control. He said blatantly, we control all these Chechens. And not only the Chechens who are in Syria or trafficking between Iraq and Syria, but the Chechens in the Caucasus itself. And Bandar says explicitly, we run all these people, just like he ran 98% of the Mujahideen in the 80s in Afghanistan. So on the other hand, they had an agreement on Egypt, because Putin is very much afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood, all over, supported by Qatar, obviously. So getting rid of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was okay for Russia. But this Assad business, forget it. The pipeline business, completely stupid, because Russia is in control of all this. They have strategic partnership with Germany. They're building Nord Stream and the South Stream. There's no way the Saudis are going to interfere with that. And they don't even have gas to sell to Europe. Qatar has gas to sell to Europe. And that's the introduction for us to start talking about Iran, Iraq, Syria pipeline. So in the end, Bandar threatened Putin, saying literally, there's only a military solution for Syria left. This is what we are watching now. So this is the Saudi part of the BBB axis, let's put it this way. Bandar, Bibi, and Barry Obama. It's the 3B axis, in fact. And this joke is, by the way, circulating all over the Middle East already, you know. So what happened with Qatar? So with Bandar pressing, especially the Obama administration, telling, look, Qatar, it's ridiculous. In a phone call, he actually said, Qatar is 300 people at the TV station, which is not very far from the truth. You know, I go to Qatar every year, and that's it. And the people that I talk to, that I get information from, are Egyptian documentary filmmakers, Somali guards. Never anybody from the government is going to ask me my questions. Never. Answer my question. Never. So, anyway, Bandar impressed to the Obama administration, look, I am in charge now. King Abdullah told me that I have free hand in Syria. I'm the director of Saudi intelligence. I'm going to run this whole show, and I don't want these upstarts from Qatar. They have to be out. This explains why the Syrian National Council, or Council from Above, all the name that they have this week, with the guy that is in charge this week before he resigns. We don't even know who these people are anymore. These are out of the picture. So now it's Bandar running the show. This explains a lot of what's going on now, including the possibility of a false flag. Because Bandar is running not only, not Salafi jihadists, but Salafis or hardcore Wahhabis, but also Salafi jihadists as well, and even connecting with the Jabhat al-Nusra al-Qaeda in Iraq gangs as well. Considering that, last month in Baghdad, they dismantled a cell fabricating chemical weapons, in fact. This was the Iraqi Ministry of Defense and the Iraqi Ministry of Interior. They announced that over a month ago. So the way I see this false flag, they introduced some of these jihadis to a place in northeast of Damascus, already occupied by the Free Syrian Army and the collection of gangs and the opposition, since June, by the way. And that's where the rockets originated, probably DIY rockets. And this is what the UN inspector should be evaluating now, before, it's crazy. They're forced to leave this Saturday. So they had less than a week to conduct an extremely complicated investigation that the Russians, when they conducted their own investigation concerning a chemical weapons attack last March, it took them 3 months for the investigation, 1 month to organize the report, and then they went to the UN and they presented the report. You can easily find the link on the net with Vitaly Churkin, UN ambassador, Russian ambassador at the UN, his press conference about it. So, Qatar was completely marginalized, and Qatar's agenda from the beginning regarding Syria had everything to do with this pipeline. So imagine a pipeline originating in the South Pars gas fields, largest gas field in the world shared by Iran and Qatar. So originating the Iranian part, then traversing Iraq, then traversing Syria, ending in the Eastern Mediterranean, probably near Latakia or Tartus or one of them, or a new naval terminal between both of them, probably with an extension to Lebanon as well. Customers, European Union, once again, shooting themselves at their feet, which is their number one sport. Same old story. I think we discussed already that, James. What I've been listening every time I go to Brussels for the past, I don't know, 10 years, 12 years, whatever. Ah, Gazprom, we are hostages of Gazprom. If only you could have a deal with the Iranians. They can't because of the U.S. sanctions. And obviously, they don't want to antagonize the U.S. This would be the perfect, you know, situation for the European Union. They say they have an energy policy. They don't. For their energy policy to be coordinated with Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and get the gas from this pipeline, considering they're never going to get gas from Turkmenistan or from Azerbaijan. The problem is that the whole situation now changed because Qatar is out of the picture. We know the pipeline is not going to be built with a war situation. The same thing applies to the TAPI pipeline through Afghanistan for the past 15 years, right? And at the same time, with the Saudis controlling all this and threatening Putin at the same time, the whole thing is muddled. Because the Saudis, they don't have an alternative pipeline to propose to Europe because they don't have enough gas. Qatar has enough gas. So the Saudis and the Qataris now, they were more or less, there was a rapprochement for 2 years or so, and now they're completely divergent because their agendas are different. The Qataris support the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Saudis fear and despise the Muslim Brotherhood to death. So in Syria, the scenario for Bandar, ideally, would be Syria transformed into a sort of emirate, a Wahhabi-predominantly emirate controlled by Sunnis with the Sunni business classes in Damascus allied with Riyadh, and would be a sort of dependency of Saudi Arabia, just like Egypt is nowadays. Now that King Abdullah in Riyadh is paying the bills, basically, of the new Egyptian government. So as you can see, the whole thing is completely muddled. But the Pakistan angle is still there. But Qatar is out of the picture. And the Iranians are looking at it, playing their cards very close to their chest. They know that if Bandar stays, if Assad remains in place, crazy, if Assad remains in after Tomahawks, bombings, you name it, in 6 months, there's going to have some sort of deal. I was discussing this with a notable Saudi the other night. If this goes on, then Bandar is going to look at the mirror and say, okay, let's cut a deal with Assad. And, okay, we're now going to be able to depose them. And then we go back to the problem. So the pipeline is going to be built in this case. If Assad predominates, if he's elected president in 2014, there are going to be elections next year. So, you know, we are in this intermediate stage. But the pipeline angle is always there. And it has everything to do with the power play between Saudi and Qatar. And don't forget Turkey. This pipeline, if it's built, will bypass Turkey. Turkey builds itself as the prime energy crossroads between East and West. Obviously, they cannot condone a pipeline that skirts their territory completely, unlike the BTC, right? They built the crazy BTC, Clinton administration, just to bypass Iran. They spent $5 billion, and it goes across Turkish territory. So they get some of the energy, and they get transit rights as well. It's not going to happen with the Iran-Iraq-Syria pipeline. So this is where we are at the moment. Of course, it's evolving, but you can see how extremely complex the whole situation is.
It's mind-bogglingly complex unless you're following it, and you do a good job of laying that out on the table. But one thing that I'm skeptical about or quizzical about, if Assad does survive and is able to continue forward, you think that this is a viable, real project that could really be brought online? Because to my mind, pipelines are the easiest, softest targets to hit, especially if you do have an army of jihadists who are already stirred up in the region. Wouldn't it be easier for someone like Bandar just to attack the pipeline?
Of course. Just like they attacked the Kirkuk pipeline practically every month, in fact. They were attacking the pipeline from Egypt to Israel as well, even last year. Yes, but if Europe is behind it, because they're going to be the customers, this implies, building the pipeline implies a lot of things. Number one, financing. It's going to cost $10 billion. Iran doesn't have $10 billion. Iraq might have two or three. Syria, 500 million. You know, so this has to come from the Russians or the Chinese. If Gazprom is involved, they want to control the customers. They want to control distribution as well. If the Chinese are involved, they want the gas for themselves. But if the Europeans finally cut a deal directly in, the European Union as a whole, not only Germany or only Italy, Brussels goes to Tehran and they cut an European Union strategic deal with the Iranians. They invest a lot in the Iranian energy infrastructure. They still need, the last figure that I have is they need $200 billion to upgrade their energy infrastructure. They depend from Russia, China, or Europe. That's it. There are three options, right? And obviously, this would imply that the European Union will have really an independent political and energy policy, completely independent from the U.S., which I think is not going to happen. But it would be their way out to escape what they're always complaining about, the so-called stranglehold by Gazprom.
Well, if politics makes strange bedfellows, I guess pipelines make even stranger bedfellows. So I find it head scratching at the very least to think of Europe getting into bed with Tehran. But I suppose stranger things have happened. So again, we'll have to. I mean, so much depends on what happens in the coming days, obviously, and how and when and if this strike occurs. And there's a lot going on in this regard. First off, let's talk about the chemical weapons attack in some more detail. Do you have any sources? What are you hearing? What's the buzz on the street about what actually occurred in Damascus?
Well, what I wrote about, I think I already alluded to it in two of my articles, at least. They are independent investigations, and the best possibility is that these rockets, probably DIY, and the Russian intelligence is saying the same thing. These were artisanal rockets. These were not Syrian army rockets. So the Russians support this possibility. They came from a place called Kabun, Kabun can be conflated with Duma as well for some reason, the way they pronounce it or the way they refer to it. Anyway, this the origin of the rockets was a base, an army base, that was captured by the rebels last June. So it would be the perfect place for a false flag operation, because technically the Syrian army controls it. Not anymore, since June. So this explains why the Syrians cannot straight away say this came from Kabul. You know why? Cultural matter, losing face. They simply cannot admit that a very important base, northeast of Damascus, very close, I would say it's probably 30 kilometers northeast of Damascus, is controlled by the rebels, by rebel gangs, and even probably certainly jihadists as well. They simply cannot admit that. This, in my view, explains why they're not straight away said, no, this came from this place and this is it. The information that the Americans are working with came from the Mossad and the CIA. We all know this already. And we all know via the Israeli press as well. And I have some friends that work for as defense correspondents in Tel Aviv. That say, yes, Benny Gantz told General Martin Dempsey. He showed the documents and he showed satellite images. So the Americans are working under the assumption probably that this came from this place. What they don't know is that this place is controlled by the rebels, certainly. Or if they know, they're not admitting it. See how the whole thing is. But it's more or less established that this is something that the UN inspectors have to tell us. The most important question, what kind of gas is it? Nobody knows for sure if it's sarin. The Russians think it's not, but they still don't know. They have some intelligence on the ground, but apparently they have not collected samples. We saw the photos already. UN inspectors did collect samples a day ago. So this is the key question at the moment, I think.
Absolutely. Well, that will go some way towards establishing whether or not it's even possible that it came from Syrian stockpiles. But let's talk about the possibility of military response. There seems to be a very tight window right now for Obama, obviously heading to I believe Sweden on his way to the G20 in Russia next week, and it's to my mind inconceivable that he'd be waging a strike at the time of the G20. So I'm assuming anything that's done would have to be done before that point. Is there a window that's closing for him? Is there a possibility that window will close before the Hawks will get their way with launching the Tomahawks?
Look, the window is practically closed, James. Saturday, the inspectors leave on Saturday. They simply cannot have a result of everything that they collect, studies that go to the lab on Sunday or on Monday. It's absurd. On Tuesday, Obama is already on Air Force One going to Sweden. On Thursday next week, he's in St. Petersburg, face-to-face with Vladimir Putin and some really, really pissed off leaders of the emerging powers. I can tell you that the Brazilians, the Indians, the Indonesians, the South Koreans, they don't like this whole thing one bit. Not to mention the Chinese. There was an editorial today in the China Daily and some other editorials in the People's Daily and regional papers in China saying the same thing. This is Iraq 2.0. This is very dangerous. And they are behaving like judges and executioners in the U.S. So can you imagine what he's going to hear at the G20? So, and the window is gone. Remember, at the start of the week when Kerry had his Colin Powell moment without the vial, and he said, we have conclusive evidence, it's going to happen now. And the next day there was this frantic spinning all over. It's going to be limited. It's going to be a series of strikes. It's going to last 2 or 3 days. The 2 or 3 days are gone. That's it. It's over. It's over. And now that the Brits, David Cameron and his absolutely despicable foreign minister, William Hague, they're fighting their own parliament. Not to mention the U.S. Congress, we don't even... What is the approval rate of the U.S. Congress? Less than 10%. It's even less than the people who in the U.S. who support the war. Nah? 9% support in the U.S. for a strike against Syria. The Congress probably has 5% support. So nobody cares. But there is opposition, at least from informed observers with some access to the White House in Washington. That's a positive sign. But the whole thing, which is something that I've been exploiting this past, and trying to explain this past few days, we are at this situation because a president of the United States recklessly draws a red line without even considering the possibilities and the consequences afterward. So now he has to act because he has to act. Because he has to, you know, the famous moral obligation, which is ridiculous. Nobody buys this anymore around the world. But in terms of, in geopolitical terms, American credibility, which is already shattered all over the world as well.
But this is the point. I mean, I can't see how he can step back from this, especially after Kerry's speech. And yet I can't see how he can go forward. I mean, the only thing that I can imagine is some sort of token, half-assed bombing that's not really going to accomplish anything.
No, he's gonna. Remember, Clinton did that. Nah? Well, I remember one of his strikes. There was a lot of missiles. I think were 53 or 54 missiles against Afghanistan. So Obama could launch 10, 12, 15, and say, okay, that's it. This is the punishment. And, you know, the whole thing stays as it is in Syria. Nothing is going to change in Syria, of course. And Assad saves face as well. Nothing's going to happen to him, to his forces. Theoretically, no collateral damage, but we never can tell. But if this thing gets out of hand, if it's 30, 40, 50, 60 missiles and civilians start dying in Damascus, then all bets are off.
Absolutely. Well, it is an exceptionally tense situation, so obviously we're going to be keeping our eye on it, as will you. And Pepe, I would give your website out, but people can find you everywhere on the web, from Asia Times Online to Huffington Post to Al Jazeera and RT and everywhere else. So people have no problem finding you, I'm sure. So we'll put a link into your most recent article as well in the show notes for this interview for people who are interested. And absolutely, I'm looking forward to the updates coming out from Pepe Escobar. So Pepe, thank you so much for joining us today on the program.
Thank you so much, James. It's always a pleasure. And keep fighting.